This content is for institutional investors and information purposes only. It does not contain investment, financial, legal, tax, or any other advice and should not be relied upon for this purpose. The materials are not tailored to your particular personal and/or financial position. If you require advice based on your specific circumstances, you should contact a professional advisor. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers as of the date of publication, are subject to change without notice, and do not necessarily reflect Mercer's opinions.
Hello and welcome to Critical Thinking, Critical Issues. My name's Emer Walsh. I'm the head of investments for Europe. And today we are coming to you live from the Global Investment Forum here in Dublin. It's been a bumper packed couple of days, which I've really enjoyed. Spoken to a lot of clients, and private markets is one of the hot topics, one of our favorite asset classes, particularly in light of the current macroeconomic backdrop. So to start us off, maybe Michael, I'll come to you first off. So what is your take on the backdrop from an economic perspective and the knock-on impact in relation to private markets? There's been a lot of focus on valuations as investors look ahead to anticipated rate cuts over the coming couple of months.
Thanks, Seymour. I think one of the main challenges that we've seen from the higher interest rate environment is that GPs have been slow to sell the companies that they've been holding within their portfolios. And as a result of that, it's meant that distributions are a little bit slower to come back to investors. And when distributions are slower to come back to investors, it means that it's taking longer for managers themselves to be able to find new investments to make. That's kind of slowed up everything in the private market world, from fundraising, from exit activity, from new investment activity that those underlying managers are making. But now that interest rates have peaked and expected to come down a little bit, we're expecting that to unwind quite a bit later this year, which is going to create really good opportunities for investors getting back into private markets as that thaw happens. If we look across the different asset classes, when you've got a higher interest rate environment, real estate is always the quickest one to adjust. And we've seen that already in this cycle. Real estate valuations are down anywhere between 10 and 20%. So as we move later into this year, our thought process is into Q3, into Q4, those valuation adjustments will have washed through, and we see some compelling opportunities for clients later this year, particularly in areas like core real estate. Within private equity, buyout valuations have been a little bit stickier, particularly on the buyout side. It does vary by sector and by region, but in general, valuations have remained relatively constant. They've come down a little bit, but not that much. Whereas in venture capital, we have seen a much sharper valuation correction, particularly in areas like anything supporting artificial intelligence that is venture capital led. Maybe was a bit frothy for a period of time, and that's come out of it now, creating some new opportunities again for investors. Infrastructure has been very robust. Infrastructure, because of its stable cash flow, because of its quasi-inflation hedging characteristics, has meant that valuations have maintained very, very strong. And also because some of the structural trends that you can access by investing in infrastructure, for example, anything to do with digital assets, logistics, AI data centers, they've all maintained a lot of their value because of the strong interest. On the private debt side, it's probably the strongest risk-adjusted return opportunity that we're seeing. But maybe David, as our in-house expert on private debt, will have a few more thoughts to share on that.
No, thanks, Michael. As you think about private debt, and as we think about it, this core plus, and value add, and that's really across the risk spectrum in private debt. So depending on how you think about your portfolio, how much risk you're able to take, what kind of duration you have in your portfolios, there's a number of different areas. And I think if we start off with core, senior private debt looks particularly compelling from a relative value perspective. Private debt loans, mostly direct lending, boast historically high all-in yields, favorable terms for lenders, certainly from lower leverage and stronger covenants, and also lower loan-to-value ratios. So you're seeing the ability to get higher yields while also getting better covenant protections and obviously lower loan-to-values. Those are really all three things that make for a ripe environment for the senior direct lending. Certainly in Core Plus, where you're taking a little bit more risk, a little bit higher return, and certainly a little bit longer duration, We're seeing capital solutions, and that's a new term for the private debt market. But in a world of higher interest rates, where companies do have a higher interest burden, particularly private equity-backed companies, they need capital to grow their businesses. They're turning to the private debt market to really provide a very structured form of debt to help them either grow their business, because there's continued growth on all across the industry sectors, or in some instances, they need that capital to really bridge them through maybe a period of difficulty in terms of the higher interest rate environment. And frankly, it's just in some cases too expensive, depending on the company situation, to go raise private equity or venture capital money. So these capital solutions, very tailored. They do pose a little bit more risk, more return, and are longer dated. Certainly, one of the other areas in the core plus area is liquidity. Michael touched on it earlier in terms of exit activity is down for the private equity managers. So we're starting to see NAV financing or portfolio financing solutions as a very big growth area in our core plus strategies. And again, these strategies are a mix of core and core plus, but these are very highly secured loans, very low loan to values, and offer really yields in the low double digit areas. So that's really another area we're very, very focused on. And lastly, certainly, if you think about it and you look at the data, defaults are up. They're not up over the historical long-term averages, but defaults have been ticking up given higher interest rates and the burden that places on company cash flows. So we're expecting more and more credit opportunities, and those credit opportunities, really range from distressed debt, special situations, and again, maybe another form of capital solutions where a company is about to file for bankruptcy, but there's some sort of bridge loan that could get it through a out-of-court restructuring. So as we think about the spectrum, core, core plus, and value add, we're very constructive on private debt right now. And certainly with the expectations that interest rates will fall over the next couple of years, we certainly see private debt continuing to play an important role in financing the economy.
And as you said, banking regulation changes are really driving the need for private debt, for private credit funds to step in. Is there anything that could change that, or is it only the direction of travel is only one way? You know, it's only going to get bigger, the private debt space.
Well, if you think about it, since the wake of the GFC, the banking regulations that have been put in place, we don't foresee a major change in banking regulations over the next 3 to 5 years, which would suggest that the banks are going to all of a sudden come back into the lending markets in a material way. And in fact, I would say the more and more we see globally, and it certainly varies by region and by country, but banks, historically have been in the factoring business, where they provide capital to companies who are selling to major global retailers and other companies. The factoring business now is in the private debt market. And I think one of the things you think about the transition of capital and lending from banks to private debt managers do one thing, they lend money. Banks do a variety of different things. And by being specialists and having, frankly, their business franchises, private debt managers, their business franchises are really built upon making sure they get the money back. Mm. That's the first, second, and third lesson in private debt. Make sure you get your money back, and if you get some interest along the way, that's also a win. So we're seeing, again, pockets of specialty finance that historically have been in the banking area, aviation finance, maritime, receivables, inventory, plant, property, and equipment. All of that continues to move in the private debt market. We just don't see a reversal of that trend right now.
Okay, interesting. And Michael, maybe coming to you on within private equity or some of the other asset classes within private markets, anything to add from where we're seeing opportunities?
Yeah, on the private equity side in particular, a lot of our clients are showing a lot of interest in anything to do with secondaries and co-investments, because we've had this period of time where maybe clients were holding back on allocating capital to private markets, predominantly because of this denominator impact. Some of that denominator impact has washed away now at this stage. And clients, because of that, are playing a little bit of catch up. They need the NAV of their portfolio. They're going to see a drop off pretty quickly, particularly as distributions start coming through again later this year. That will mean the NAV of their portfolio will decline. And to play a bit of catch up, one of the main ways of doing that is using co-investments and secondaries, particularly within either the private equity or the infrastructure equity space, to be able to get your NAV to build back to where you want it to be. Mm. And there's a couple of advantages to using co-investments and secondaries. One particular one is to reduce blind pool risk. You can see what you're investing in. And for investors who have got concerns about valuations and they want a little bit more transparency in terms of the companies that they're investing in, they get that by seeing the secondary fund and the investments that have already been made. They get it through the co-investment because they can see what that co-investment is going to be. Mm. And they can even do their own stress testing to be able to see how might valuations change under a range of different scenarios. And that's very beneficial for any clients that are worried about valuations. It also, when you're investing via secondaries and co-investments, typically you're able to get access at much lower fees than if you invested in a traditional primary closed-end fund within private markets. Mm. So that is all helping investors to make the case for getting their portfolios back to where it would have been, being able to do so with more transparency in terms of the companies that they're investing in, and being able to do so at lower fees as well.
But is it harder to access for clients?
It is. It's a good point because you need to be quick. You need to be nimble. When these co-investment or secondary opportunities come up, they're brought to you by maybe GPs that you've got existing relationships with, or by brokers you've got a good relationship with on the secondary side. But you need to act quickly. The opportunity doesn't stay there for very, very long. You typically have maybe a 4 to 5 week period to do the investment due diligence on either the secondary fund that you're looking at or the co-investment opportunity that's being brought to you. You need to do the investment due diligence. You need to do your legal and tax due diligence, all within that 5 week time frame.
Okay, so it's tight.
It's tight. Mm. You really need a strong operational background to be able to pull it all together and get it into your fund structure.
But one of the things I'd add to that, Michael, too, is actually having a relationship with the general partner where they're bringing you the opportunity. If you do not know that general partner, and not to say that you can't do the diligence and figure it out, but with those tight time frames, having those relationships, this is still a relationship business. People do business with people. Mm. And having those long-term relationships, you're able to, in many cases, you know some of the assets because you're an investor in that fund already, and they're maybe doing a GP-led continuation vehicle, perhaps a co-investment. The company is growing. They need some extra capital from their existing LP base. So having that relationship is a very key piece of really responding not only to the transaction, but also thinking about how you put your portfolio together. And do you want this particular asset in your portfolio from an investor's perspective? So again, relationships really continue to matter in the private markets.
And maybe even going beyond the private equity side, when you look into other asset classes, we do see, I've touched on it earlier, a real opportunity within real estate. And real estate's an asset class that maybe has been out of favor for the last couple of years. But with those valuation adjustments really feeding through into the underlying net asset value of those portfolios later this year, where you're able to pick up core and core plus type really well-known, really well-established assets in the real estate space, you're investing typically via an open-ended fund structure. And the advantage of investing in an open-ended fund structure, particularly at the moment, queues into open-ended funds are extremely short right now. So for a nimble investor who's able to position themselves to take advantage dynamically of these opportunities, open-ended real estate should be an opportunity to watch out for as the year goes on.
So you can get capital in the ground quicker because open-ended funds are...
Much quicker. You can. It's one of the problems that investors often face when they're investing in private markets is getting their capital allocated, invested quickly. Mm. And also keeping it invested. Yeah. And that's one of the beauty of open-ended funds is your capital goes in and it stays invested until you decide that you need to change your asset allocation strategy.
Well, you know, that's a good point as well, because in private debt, we're seeing the emergence of semi-liquid funds and evergreen funds for that very reason. Investors want to stay invested and don't want to have necessarily closed-end vehicles where there's a ramp-up period and then obviously there's a wind-down period. And obviously, that's part of the market, and you'll have those. But in order to control your exposures from a total portfolio perspective, evergreen structures and private debt, we think, will dominate the landscape over the next 3 to 5 years. And we're seeing more and more of those structures in the market. Certainly in the United States, they're publicly listed. There's a few others around the world. But we're seeing a lot of private evergreen structures, you know, from a lot of our really highly rated managers right now.
Yeah. Particularly, I think, the demand from wealth managers, you know, they do need the liquidity. Insurers maybe less so. But I think I've heard a lot of clients talking about semi-liquid and evergreen structures. So it's obviously a key area of focus for the market.
And it's also a way to control your duration. Every investor has a different duration perspectives. Some have shorter, some have longer. So being in some of these evergreen structures allows you as the investor to control your duration risk and put that in your hands as opposed to put that in the manager's hands.
I am. We are sitting here overlooking the commercial centre in Dublin. So one question, slightly left field, but just on real estate in relation to commercial real estate. So we have seen valuations fall for real estate, but on the commercial side, do we think valuations are also bottoming out, or is maybe there a bit more to go? How is?
Yeah, I mean, valuation adjustments on the commercial side are somewhere down. Depends on the region you look at, but close to 20% at the moment, and I think. Most real estate experts that we speak to are saying valuation adjustments, given where rates have gone to, we're able to kind of do a cash flow planning to be able to see what the valuation adjustment should be. You're looking at about a 25% drawdown is what the expectation is. If we're down 20, we're not a million miles away from where the bottom might be. So certainly that's creating interesting opportunities. But I wouldn't just think about commercial real estate. There's many different opportunities in, if you think of a lot of the structural trends that are at play globally at the moment, the fact that people are living longer than they have done in the past. So demographics, demographics has meant that there's more demand for life sciences, which are accessed via real estate. Also more demand for healthcare centers, which are again built via real estate. Or even if you think about the way we're living these days, it's more streaming TV when you need it. So looking at recording studios, which are part of the real estate mandate as well, or even the way we shop in terms of last mile logistics and having centers that can store your online purchases more closer to where you want to deliver it to. Very attractive opportunities that you can access via value add type strategies in real estate too.
That's interesting. The digital theme is coming through from the forum over the last 2 days, but it's amazing that it kind of feeds through into all these core elements within private markets. So even within real estate, you can kind of get access to the, you know, innovation and digitalization of the economy that we're seeing.
Well, and in venture capital too, many of the pharmaceutical companies are using AI in order to really advance many of, from a drug development standpoint. So, you know, it sort of ties together. And even though AI might be helping with drug development, you still need property, plant, equipment to manufacture those drugs, deliver those drugs, and so forth. So, you know, I think when you think about private markets, is you really are financing the global real economy. And I think, you know, sometimes, you know, getting the transparency to understand where that private capital is in every aspect of the of the economy. Sometimes, investors, as they look through their portfolios, there are a lot things are a lot more tied together than you would appear on the surface, and I think that's the point you're bringing out, Eimear.
And last one for me on VC, and it's just in relation to a panel we had earlier. So VC, all about innovation, but Europe does seem to be slightly behind the US in terms of productivity. Leaning into digitalization, you know, from the VC side, if you're an investor, like where are you seeing the opportunities from a regional standpoint, from a global standpoint? You know, is it all in the US or is there more in Europe?
I think, you know, historically the US has been a dominant force in the venture capital markets. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But certainly we're starting to see more and more in Europe. I think certainly with digital media, AI, you can't hide from these trends. So even in our own businesses, we see, you know, efficiencies coming to the business globally. We're seeing those types of technologies coming out of the venture capital community. But I would say it's still dominated primarily in the United States. but you're seeing it across the globe more and more.
Catching up.
Yeah, they're catching up, exactly.
Europe is definitely catching up as well, being driven by political agenda. In many countries, we're seeing, for in France, for example, the TB initiative, where the French government is encouraging encouraging the pension schemes, the insurance companies, to invest in more local venture capital companies, the same in the UK. But also impact investing is a big thing within Europe in particular. Mm. And a lot of the impact strategies that if you want to access, for example, agri-tech or fintech, if it's more of a social angle to things as well, they're well accessed through more venture type strategies. And a lot of those exist within Europe as well. So it's great to see Europe playing catch up with the US when it comes to these type of strategies.
And to that point, I mean, Europe is driving climate change and you need technology in order to solve some of those problems. So I think as we think about venture capital, yes, it's technology, but it's also solving real world problems. With different types of technologies driven by some of the climate issues here in Europe. So it's not surprising that we're starting to see Europe grow, if you will, with a much deeper venture capital market than we've seen in a long time.
Yeah, it's great to see. Obviously, Michael and I are very patriotic about Europe, Europe catching up.
But also provides jobs too, and job creation, which also helps the economy.
Productivity,
right? Exactly.
It's all for the greater good.
Exactly. You know, I've and you probably remember this, Michael, you know, we were talking about there's 40% less public companies over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. There's 500% increase in the number of private companies. Companies staying private longer. But these companies, they provide jobs. They provide technologies. I mean, so the private markets are really embedded in the global. I think it's an important point. They're really embedded in the global economy.
I think we could stay here all day talking, but we do need to wrap it up. That was really interesting. David, thank you. Michael, thank you. It was great to chat. If you liked this content, to anyone listening and want to hear more, please do subscribe to our podcast and leave a review or reach out to your local Mercer representative. Thank you for listening. I'll sign off from Dublin.